Liz, I'm sure this couldn't possibly be your first appearance in front of this group, but I think it's the first appearance in your new guise of not actually working for us full time.
Does that mean that the same rules apply? Everybody has to be nice to me?
I think so. But everybody would be nice to you anyway.
That doesn't seem fair.
Well, I suppose actually we've got to reinterpret this principle and apply it differently for Tack, who isn't quite sure if he's an IFRIC member or a board member at the moment. So, in fact, Tack especially has to be nice to you because this is the first time he has appeared in front of you. Okay. This is Agenda Paper 3, dealing with put options written over non-controlling interests.
Okay. So Agenda Paper 3 continues the discussion of puts on NCI. So how to account for put options written on non-controlling interests in the consolidated financial statements of the controlling shareholder. Constituents raised this issue because there's some diversity in practice in how to subsequently measure these instruments. So in January, the committee talked about some possible ways to address the issue, including a scope exclusion from IAS 32 for NCI puts. And the committee asked us to explore the viability of such a scope exclusion. Agenda Paper 3 sets out how the scope exclusion might work. So specifically, if NCI puts were scoped out of IAS 32, their measurement basis would change to that used for other derivative contracts. So they no longer would be grossed up and measured at the present value of the exercise price, but instead they'd be measured on a net basis like a derivative. Paragraphs 17 and 18 in the paper describe additional details of the scope exclusion, and we've also set out some advantages and disadvantages. But overall, we think it's a viable solution. And if the committee supports a scope exclusion, we recommend that you refer this issue and the potential solution to the board. The question for you is set out after paragraph 27 in the paper, and that is, does the committee support the scope exclusion that's described in the paper? And if so, do you want to refer the issue and possible solution to the board? Or if not, what would you like to do instead and why?
Bearing in mind that this committee doesn't have the power to amend IAS 32 on its own, that sort of limits our options a bit.
Correct.
Okay. Anybody want to make any comment, observation? Joanna?
Well, I'll start by saying congratulations, Liz. I am going to be nice to you. I thought it was an excellent paper, and I 100% agree with your recommendation. End of story.
Guido, can you also be succinct?
Well, congratulations also from my side. I have some minor points. In general, I think it's a good solution to do this. But first thing is, I have something here in writing, maybe we can talk about that later on. I think that we also need to change something in the scope paragraph of IAS 39, because it seems to me that now these derivatives would be scoped out of 39, and we need to make sure that these new derivatives are part of IAS 39, and especially think of paragraphs 2A and D, to make sure that these derivatives are within IAS 39.
Okay, if I could just respond to that real quick. The appendix was only to show committee members the primary changes, and those primary changes would be made to IAS 32 by not including any other, I guess, minor consequential amendments. I didn't mean to imply that no more were necessary. I wanted to focus on the primary changes, and I think those would be to 32. But certainly if we go forward with this potential solution, the staff will make sure that any other consequential amendments are made.
Okay, so second point, I was coming to the scope exclusion in 17 and 18. I was asking myself, is this an issue in separate financial statements at all? Because my understanding is that you would not show this financial instruments in the separate financial statements. You would not show this as a liability because it's not part of the equity. We are talking about equity instruments of a subsidiary, right?
Right. So I think there's a couple of reasons this isn't an issue in the separate statement. So in the separate statement of, say, the parent, you're right, this wouldn't be a derivative over their own equity, so it would normally be recognized net as a derivative. The only place it could be an issue is if the subsidiary writes a put over their own shares. In the consolidated statements, this amendment would apply, and that derivative would be net. However, in the standalone statement of the subsidiary who just wrote a derivative on their own shares, that would still be grossed up.
Okay. Well, two more points on the scope out in 18. One is, and you also recognize that this might be a problem, that's a scope out of puts that are embedded in a contract or a financial instrument. Maybe financial instrument might be a better way to describe it, not contract. We have the same problems here. I cannot see any rationale why that would still be accounted differently from a put option that is not embedded in the contract or in the financial instrument. So I'm a little bit, I can see that we are trying to solve this problem here. I can't see a rationale for finding a solution for these puts that are not embedded, and for puts that are embedded in a financial instrument, we still have the old accounting.
Really, my primary objective with that paragraph was just to be abundantly clear that we're not suggesting that the board talk about puttable shares. So we're only talking about a standalone put. So that, I mean, maybe that particular paragraph is stating the obvious, but I just want to make it abundantly clear that the board isn't reopening the issue of puttable shares. We're just talking about these standalone.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that the board, that's probably a larger issue to address. From a point, you know, from a user point of view, economically, for me, that's, we have the same situation, whether it's embedded in the instrument or not, and we are accounting for them differently, so that comparability seems to be an issue here. But I don't want to hinder the solution that we have here. It's just one observation. And the last one that I have is for the, I think in paragraph 22, we scope out, at least that's one of the examples, forwards. So we only would have standalone put options that would fall under this exception, but not forwards. There are issues out there where you have synthetic forwards and this kind of stuff. So I think that we need to, or that the staff and the board needs to think about this issue.
We need to draw a line between what it is we're doing in response to the request we received over written puts and what the board is doing as part of its larger project on financial instruments with characteristics of equity.
Yeah.
I agree with all of your points from a broader perspective, and Philippe and Weigro, and particularly TAC, I'm sure will be listening to those because the post-2011 agenda is likely to have these issues on there. This is something that was brought to us, and particularly, I think, by regulators, as being of current concern to deal with the put issues. So we've limited the scope only to that, rather than the broader scope.
I could understand that, Bob, for looking at an interpretation, but a change that the board is making, it's sometimes hard to understand for constituents that you are just dealing with this very specific issue.
Yeah, this is not going to be an interpretation. This is work that we are doing to assist the board whilst they're finalising some other projects at the moment. This is not an interpretive project. This is something that we're recommending as a practical solution to the existing problem of written puts that will then be put to the board. The board, I think, is then the organisation that should make the decision as to whether they will deal with this as a standalone, shall we say, more urgent amendment, separate from the larger project on FICE, or if, in fact, they feel that the other issues, as you've identified as well, are of equal significance and therefore that they will defer any action on this and only take it as part of the larger project.
That
I think the encouragement that we had decided we will give before to the board was that they took this narrow scope as being the one that is urgent, that needs to be resolved more expeditiously. And that's why we're doing the work.
That was actually what I wanted to say, and we need to make sure that this is really more urgent and more divergent in practice than forwards, because if we solve this problem and then constituents come back and say we have the same problem for forwards, and you can see them very often. That was just a point I wanted to make, that we need to make sure that we are not just looking at one issue and then constituents come back and say, well, it's nice that you deal with this issue, but others are as important as this.
That's fine. Liz, I really don't want you to remind me, so it isn't a question you have to respond to, but sort of approximately how long has it been that standard setters, FASB and the ISB, might have been looking at financial instruments with characteristics of entity?
Over 20 years, I think.
So be careful what you wish for. Philippe, did you want to make a comment?
Bob, you made the point. I think the board will have to address as part of its due process whether we limit the amendment to that very point or whether we make it a bit broader. I think the board will have, speaking for myself, obviously the board will have little appetite to deal on a short-term basis with a broader project. Whether or not we will reopen IS-42 on FICE after June is to be discussed, but I think we are aware that there is an urgent issue which is relatively limited, and there is a solution to deal with that. The revenue process, we'll see, and when we expose the solution, maybe a lot of people will wake up and say, oh, but we also have this point on forwards, and there is a solution we can see. But it seems to me the evidence today that the problem is it puts on SCI. That is the problem where IFRIC has been asked to look at, and unless we find other evidence, we probably will do that only.
Andrew.
I'm okay with the direction this is going, but just a couple of comments, if I may. I think there are obviously some fairly important drafting issues to consider, because my understanding, the whole point of going down this route was to avoid volatility in the P&L account where people didn't think that was the right thing to do. And I think the way this is going at the moment, by scoping these things out of 32 in their entirety rather than just paragraph 23 of 32, is that if you've got a put option which is a fixed price for a fixed number of shares and meets the definition of equity, we're scoping that out of 32 potentially, and therefore we're going to have to fair value that, and that will get volatility in the P&L account, which is exactly the opposite of what we tried to do. So I think that can be fixed by drafting. The other thing that...
Sorry, what do you want us to fix, Andrew? I don't think it's our objective to reduce volatility in P&L. It's our duty to reflect changes in value that should be recorded.
Well, it's an equity instrument, so if you scope that out of 32, it's no longer an equity instrument, so what do you do with it? You fair value it?
But even today, puts that meet the definition of equity are still grossed up.
Yeah, but the only thing you get in P&L is the unwind of the discount.
That's right.
Here you're going to get fair value on an equity instrument on the basis of movements in the share price.
I guess going back to what Bob or somebody else said, it'll be interesting, you know, just hypothetically, if you know, this amendment was published as the way it's written now, I'm not convinced that everyone would like it for that point exactly, because there's some people that aren't getting volatility today that will get volatility under the amendments.
You could fix that by scoping these things out of paragraph 23 of 32 as opposed to the entire standard.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason, my understanding of the background of why it was suggested that we just scope it out, just have a scope exclusion, was the simplicity of that amendment. I mean, to scope it out of paragraph 23 would be a bit more complicated.
Well, but it's going to create volatility where we don't have volatility at the moment. That's what I'm saying.
It is, but one of the concerns about the current accounting was that we were getting volatility for situations where there was no change in the economics. You're paying fair value for the shares under the put, and so you're paying what they're worth. So it's not going in or out of the money. Whereas a fixed price put, you could find yourself with the contract going in or out of the money, and so therefore there is a real change to the economics. So to reflect those economics would be reasonable.
Well, that's fine, but that currently meets the definition of an equity instrument. Fixed price for a fixed number of shares.
I mean, the only other potential solution would be to narrow the scope exclusion even further and say the scope exclusion only applies to fixed price puts. Or, I'm sorry, to fair value puts, excuse me.
Or any puts that didn't have a fixed price.
Fixed price or a fair value, but will still apply. But I think that I thought about the argument made by Andrew. But I think in that situation there is really an economic substance, because there is a risk in relation to the fixed price to the fair value. So. I'm not. I do agree, but as far as we wanted to reflect more an economic situation, I'm not. I still do support the solution. I think that's the economics.
Laurence.
Yes. Can I tell to committee members that in France we had a research group looking at it, at this issue, looking at the solutions and so on. And we did consider the fact that effectively fixed price puts would be captured, measured at fair value with P&L volatility. The concern that existed in the first place was not the P&L volatility in itself. It was that the P&L volatility was creating counterintuitive results, that the P&L effects were difficult to explain from an economic standpoint. The group, which included preparers in France and various parties, it was a very diverse group, considered that in the case of fixed price puts, it was providing good information to treat them as derivatives and to show the changes in P&Ls. So it was not much to be afraid of the volatility, it was to ensure that the P&L effects reflected something that made sense from an economic standpoint and reflected the transactions effectively. So this is why the research group in France does support the proposals as they are set out in the paper.
Laurence, out of curiosity, were there any French banks in that group?
Absolutely.
Then we should be worried.
Can I just
Andrew, do you want to come back on this?
I don't mind that. I personally would never have been in this place in the first place. So I thought the answer was clear under the current standards. But why not? I understand the economics of what you're saying about fixed price puts, but then why not fair value fixed price forwards? I mean, you know, what's the difference?
It's a limited amendment. Let's move on.
Yeah, so. Can I just make one more point about drawing a line between fixed price and non-fixed price? I just want to remind everybody that one of the most popular questions that I think the staff gets is, what does fixed mean? What does fixed for fixed mean? So while it may seem like a very easy line to draw between fixed price and non-fixed price, if we dig into it, we might find that it's actually more difficult than we thought, just given the amount of questions we get today about what does fixed mean or how fixed is fixed.
Fair value is fixed, isn't it? Bruce?
I also support the direction this is going, and I think the scope needs to be as narrow as possible. We were presented with a particular situation. My understanding was there were situations where there are puts on NCI which are not causing diversity in practice. And that example was where they effectively formed part of contingent consideration, such that control passed on day one. And my concern is that we're excluding those as well in this scope exclusion. So I would like us to be as narrow as possible to solve the practice issue, which I thought was fair value puts. That was the issue that we had, and that the problem was not the volatility so much as the fact that she was still recording the NCI and having to also deal with this liability and take the change through P&L. Whereas in the other situation where you had contingent consideration such that you no longer had NCI, you didn't have the problem. And my concern is that this scope exclusion is going to include those situations as well.
See, I didn't think that this scope exclusion would, and I hope that Alan or Michael hops in if I start going off track here. But my understanding is if a present ownership interest is passed such that the controlling shareholder has a present ownership interest in the shares under the put, the NCI, according to IAS 27, doesn't exist anymore. So if the NCI doesn't exist anymore, the put doesn't exist anymore. So by the time that you get to this scope exclusion, there's no issue anymore because IAS 27 has taken care of it.
But that's why I don't think this addresses it. That's why I was a bit concerned where you said earlier on, and I'm sorry, I missed it right at the beginning, nothing needs to be done to IAS 27, nothing needs to be done to IAS 39. I think we need to make it, if that is the case, which I would support, then we need to make it clear that that is the case.
Okay. See, I would have just thought that that was the case today.
Well, I don't think people will read that exclusion that way.
Is that then, Ruth, something you would suggest is in really a consequential amendment to clarify in those standards?
Yes, and whether it's in 27 or 32, I don't mind, as long as it's clear that what we're doing.
But the main amendment's in 32, and there may be something else in 27 for those situations. But I think if we didn't intend that they would be affected by this, then we just need to make that clear. Yeah. Solve a question coming back to us later. Scott?
Bob, I think the direction that this is headed is fine. The discussion we're having, you know, shows all the concerns about making this kind of limited change to target specific instruments. There's other instruments that have some of the same economics. We're not changing those. You know, I frankly have trouble with, you know, doing puts on one kind of equity in one way and puts on other kinds of equity in another way, which, you know, we're not changing puts on parent equity. But, I mean, given the fact that I think the proposed accounting is better, I'm supportive of where we're going, but I think we kind of have to stop talking about the other similar situations that we're not covering because we're going to drive ourselves into the ground. I mean, there are plenty of similar instruments that we're not picking up that if you look at the accounting for them, you say, well, that's just as bad as the ones we just fixed. Why don't we fix these other things as well? And pretty soon we'll take on the entire liabilities and equity project, which is fine. Frankly, we can't go slower than the boards have gone on that project, and maybe we'll get there. But I think if we're gonna take on the issue that we're trying to take on, you know, we kind of have to put the blinders on because we know if we look, it's going to be ugly.
It's rather similar to the situation we had a couple of years ago with rights issues that were the flavor of the day, issued in multiple currencies.
Right.
And whilst there were many other things that some board members at that time thought we should have fixed, that it would have delayed the project and resulted in counterintuitive accounting for much longer. And we, none of us, like to see people using true and fair overrides. Andrew, final word.
Sorry, I did have two more comments. Yes, I'm not sure the way the thing is currently drafted, just to flag that it would scope out a situation where you've got settlement options, where you've got where you can settle the put gross or net. So you might want to think about that in drafting, because I assume we would want to capture that situation.
My intention was to, and I want to make sure that I get your point correctly, my intention was to scope out anything that otherwise would have been captured in paragraph 23 of 32.
Right.
So I tried to carry the language in 23 over into this. So that's my intention.
Okay, well, I've got some drafting suggestions.
Okay.
And the second thing, just coming back on the puttables, I certainly don't want to go there, but I do think there is a genuine reason for distinguishing puttables from this kind of put. I mean, a puttable instrument is actually defined as a liability, classified by way of exception as equity. That is a different situation from the minority put. So I think there's a conceptual basis for drawing a distinction, not that we're just not going there.
Okay. Then
Bob, am
you don't have to... Oh, Lucas, sorry, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. I have only a couple of concerns. The first one is that the direction is in the way to try to find a short-term solution because we predict or we see that the more comprehensive projects on the financial instruments with characteristics of equity could be able to solve the problem in a more specific way. I have the feeling that we have also a long track record of cases in which also good project has not been finalized by the YARG, so we have to be sure about what we are doing, because we will probably produce something that's not necessary will be a short-term solution, but could be a very long-term solution. And from the discussion that we have, and also from my opinion, there are some elements of conceptual elements that have not been fully analyzed or fully indicated. In this sense, we are going to narrow as much as we can the definition of the item that we are regulating. But I think that it's important to think about that this scope exclusion could have a very long time application, because we have no specific elements regarding the future combination or the combination with the financial instruments with characteristics of equity projects. The second element is that, in my opinion, even though this solution is very practical, and therefore is go on a way that could be also acceptable in certain circumstances, I would like to underline that put option on non-minority interests has absolutely the form of derivatives, but not necessarily are driven by the same economics underlying of the derivatives. When you have a put on a non-controlling interest, you have something that is also linked with partnership with the other counterparty, with the corporate governance, with other lots of other elements. And sometimes the exercise of the put is not linked with only the fair value of the underlying assets compared to the strike price, but it's also linked with a lot of other elements that are not necessary considered inside the definition of a derivative. The other element is that the underlining in this case is very specific, because it's quite strange that you have an underlying that you can manage, because you are speaking about a puts on a value that is the value of your subsidiary, so something that you can manage. So it is acceptable to go to a net presentation, but I would like to put to the attention that not necessary, or in many cases, the economic underlinings, the put option on non-controlling interest are not driven by the same economics consideration for normal freestanding derivatives. Therefore, also the accounting could be not necessarily the same. That's all.
Okay, Luca, I think we can take those points up in the note that will go to the board, and I'm assuming that you weren't suggesting that any changes go through OCI because of this different relationship, but let's proceed. We also, I think, Liz, need to just remind the board of the consequence of this exemption on fixed price puts. And I think the comments that Laurence and Jean-Louis had made about, as it were, avoiding counterintuitive volatility in profit and loss, not in banning volatility, is a good point to make. At this stage, I suppose we're in your hands. My thought and intention, Alan and Michael, would be that Liz works up the amendments that need to be made, including all the consequential amendments for clarification also in 39 and 27. And I think it would be helpful for committee members and also productive for the board as well if at some stage you could circulate those drafting suggestions around here. We can do it offline. We don't do drafting in the committee. So whenever that's convenient to you and everybody else, so we've got those comments. And then in due course, when the board has, I suppose it'll only take about 15 or 20 minutes, a little bit of time on the board agenda, Alan, that you can take it through. TAC, we rely on you, as well as relying on Philippe and Wei Guo, to make sure that the board is diligent and considers these issues going forward. All right. Well, thank you for that. Thank you, Liz. As expected, it was an excellent presentation. I think we'll take a break for lunch now, reconvene at 1:30 London time, and then we'll continue in the order of the agenda. So, thank you.